Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Deputy Mayor Watt, for that very generous introduction. Mr. Erdahl, Mayor McGee, distinguished guests and members of the International City Management Association, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank you all for inviting me here today. Actually, you've never mailed me a formal invitation. Jack Anderson leaked it to me. Today marks the formal beginning of a campaign. This morning we picked up our planes at National Airport in Washington, and we hit the trail. Whenever I fly commercially, I always fly American Airlines. I figure that's the safest airline. There's no hijacker in the world who would want to risk having to sit through a commercial from Chet Huntley. But actually, the campaign began in Miami at our convention. We had a very interesting convention. And some singular things happened there that weren't reported by the media. For example, Charlton Heston was there with Billy Graham. And they got in an argument on the beach one day over who would part the Atlantic. Very interesting. My visit here today has a dual purpose. I'm not only here in my continuing role as the president's liaison with city government, but I'm also here as a political campaigner. However, I want you to know that I'm not hostile to the Democratic contenders. And the president certainly has made every effort to maintain a bipartisan spirit insofar as the city, county, state, federal relationship is concerned. And he urged members of the administration to be friendly to our opponents. Just yesterday, he suggested that I ask George McGovern to play golf. Good. But my foremost public purpose during this campaign will be to focus attention on the programs and policies of the Nixon administration. We believe that those programs have been innovative and salutary, and that they have brought constructive changes to the country in many areas of our national life, and that they offer bright hope for the future. So it will be a pleasure to have an opportunity to better acquaint the public with them. Now, we who hold public office would like to think that the people are fully aware of our accomplishments, especially those that we're proudest of. But unfortunately, you and I know this is not always the case. As you know so well, constructive change, or as it sometimes characterized progress, gradually evolves from long hours of thoughtful study, careful planning, and forceful execution. Usually, it's witnessed on a day-to-day basis only by those who are most intimately involved, people like yourselves who are responsible for the development and implementation of policy. Governmental progress is seldom fully illuminated until an election year, and that's when a public takes the measure of a man, examines his record in office, examines it in detail, and judges him by comparison with his opponent, and by examining whatever that opponent may offer as alternatives to the course of action he's been pursuing during the time he's invested with the public trust. And so I shall be bringing to the public attention in the weeks ahead the positive record of accomplishment of Richard Nixon's first 4 years in the presidency. And from time to time, no doubt, I'll be called upon to contrast that record with the rather meager, probably well-intentioned, but often inconsistent and poorly thought-out offerings of his opponent. Now, there's much in Richard Nixon's presidency that we take great pride in. His efforts to build a world peace and a new era of cooperation and goodwill among the great powers of the world. His complete turnabout of a world war, of a war in Southeast Asia, involving more than 500,000 young Americans and taking the lives of up to 300 of them a week at its peak. His steady conversion of the armed forces toward an all-volunteer service, eliminating the need for a draft that at one time was taking up to 30,000 young Americans a month. That was the time when he took office. His successful efforts to shift our economy from a wartime to a peacetime footing with a minimum of dislocation, and to curb the galloping inflation that was consuming paychecks faster than new raises could take effect. His innovative proposals to reform the institutions and programs of government, yes, and even the structure of government itself, reforms, I might add, that have been only fractionally enacted and that we're going to continue to press for until they are enacted. Yes, we're proud of all these accomplishments and many more. But of all the president's domestic accomplishments, the one that gives me the greatest satisfaction as a former county and state and now as a federal official, the one that I believe has the longest range impact and promises the greatest good for this country, is the great, fresh, new thinking that he has brought to the concept of government itself. The new federalism, as you city and county officials well realize, is not a label. It's a philosophy. It's a belief that's deeply held by Richard Nixon and by those of us associated with him, that for too long, power has flowed from state and local government. It's a determination to reverse that flow and to send power back in the direction of the grassroots of America from whence come the tax dollars. It's a decision to work to bring government closer to the people and to make it more quickly responsive to the citizenry. We'll be witnessing in a few days congressional enactment of the cornerstone of that philosophy, that which we call revenue sharing. Now, just a few years ago, the concept of earmarking as a percentage, earmarking a percentage of the federal income tax receipts for state and local government use was what we might call a drawing board dream, a topic for much academic discussion and some politically motivated importuning at conferences of governors, county and city officials, and members of legislative bodies at all levels. But with the strong bipartisan assistance of officials at all levels of government, and I want to pause here to pay my personal tribute to the many officials, professional, career, those who were or were not elected, but who regarded government as a purely nonpartisan function to deliver services to the public. The work that these people did in revenue sharing, the support and the reception that we got as we went around the country in those unpopular days, kept us going. And now we have, through that support, made revenue sharing a central part of our domestic program. For 3 years, we urged the enactment by Congress, and finally, a majority of congressional members was persuaded of the wisdom and urgency of the program. And your executive director, Mark Keene, sat in White House councils on that subject. He and my city manager, your association's president, Graham Watt, are vividly aware of the president's unflagging commitment to this goal as well as to other parts of the new federalism. As historic as the enactment of revenue sharing will be, we hope that it's only the first step in returning more authority and more resources and more responsibility to state and local government. The president seeks that same objective in his proposal to combine categorical grants into broader, more flexible programs that will be much more easily and more efficiently administered by people such as yourselves at the city and county levels. This understanding that we have about focusing our attention on these ideas that whose time has come is most important to the preservation of a flexible tripartite system of government, such as we have today. We call this undertaking special revenue sharing. It's been stalled in the Congress, but we're going to continue to press for its enactment. And along with the reorganization of the executive branch of the federal government, which, as you know, the president has also proposed, special revenue sharing will make possible more effective administration at all levels of government. We hope we have a strong mandate from the voters in November for the enactment of both of these programs. I think I can capsulize it in this fashion. Richard Nixon has ended the patronizing, paternalistic thinking that was dominant in Washington through much of the 1960s, and I am confident that the voters will reaffirm in November that he acted correctly. The president has genuine confidence in local officials, those who are closest to the people and best able to administer local affairs. He believes it is absolutely essential that there be an end to the pumping of federal money directly into neighborhood groups and independent organizations with no responsibility to the people or to their elected officials with regard to its efficient and proper use. The bypassing of City Hall, both in the planning and execution of programs, is being brought to an end just as fast as we can do it. I don't want that comment to be construed as an opinion on my part that community groups do not render a valuable service. What I'm saying is that the most efficient use of those people with the civic consciousness to involve themselves in the day-to-day decisions of their neighborhood or their city can be constructively harnessed as a very positive force if they work through the established elected officials and their professional advisors. The direct funding of inexperienced people who have no idea as to what the policy or programs of City Hall amount to, and who sometimes work at counterpurposes to the professionals in government, is causing an alienation, a destruction of efficient city management that I find is chronic and endemic throughout the country. What happens is that plans that have been carefully heard over the years suddenly are rejected because some community group or other, at times under the influence of politically ambitious people who really have not bothered to inform themselves of the safeguarding pre-hearings that have taken place, stop progress in its tracks. How many highway programs do you know for inner city highways that have been stopped by neighborhood fears funded by the federal government? How many times has a worthy urban renewal project or a housing project been dislocated, held up to the point that the continuing rise in costs makes it no more feasible? That's what I mean by saying that in the final analysis, we have a responsive representative system of government. And if we have that, and if no one contests it, why can't we use the elected officials as the implementing source for whatever takes place in the way of local governmental decision? Why do we have to turn to non-elected people who are at political cross purposes with the designated representatives of the people and thereby give them a capability to thwart those who have been legitimately designated under our system to implement the decisions of the people? That's what I say is wrong. Using executive authority wherever possible, the president has cut away much of the red tape that entangled the administration of federal programs at the regional level. And you're going to hear some of his initiatives this afternoon from our budget director, Cap Weinberger, and assistant director, Dwight Ink. While the public may not be generally familiar with such terms as plan variation, joint funding, integrated grants, special revenue sharing, executive reorganization, and allied services, they mean a great deal to this group and to others who have to work with federal programs on a day-to-day basis. The president is also bringing the tools of science and technology to bear in helping to solve the domestic problems in the city. he's proposed a far broader federal approach to utilizing research and development and greater access to these resources by state and local government. Richard Nixon has demonstrated his concern for state and local government, and he's making every effort to strengthen their ability to solve the problems they face. And this, in turn, we feel and we sense has fostered a new spirit of cooperation between the governmental entities at the various levels. Right here in the Minneapolis area, there's an outstanding example of local initiative and local cooperation. And I refer to the innovative Share the Growth Plan, under which 40% of this region's new commercial and industrial property base is pooled with the revenues distributed among local jurisdictions on a modified population basis. While this approach may not be in exactitude suitable for every metropolitan area, it demonstrates the kind of imaginative, experimental thinking that is needed to solve the problems of growing metropolitan areas. And I'm also convinced, as the former head of a very diversified county with a considerable metropolitan area, that we are not going to solve the problems of the city until the individual citizen who lives in the suburbs, but who enjoys all the benefits of the city, takes a greater personal interest in city problems, in crime and poverty and unemployment and inadequate housing and traffic congestion. These things are nightmares that respect no geographic boundaries or mythical lines, and the citizens of a metropolitan area would do well to concern themselves with these problems and face the fact that they cannot be escaped simply by moving. If the city rots, the county and the suburbs and all of those delightful beltway industries that are there because there's a beltway and provide such a great base for the county, all those things are going to go too. Because if there's no city, there's nothing to have a beltway around. And if there's no beltway there, there's not going to be that great light industry that provides such a beautiful tax base for the suburban county. So we must make certain that we preserve the city and enhance its unusual and really unique functions of being a cultural center and a hub for the principal and major transportation and attractive industry that brings about the relocation and development of much of the suburbs that surround it. We must learn to harness in tandem our vast resources and talents, both as governments and as individuals, if we're ever going to solve all of these pressing domestic difficulties. Now, this administration is committed to a new philosophy and a new era in intergovernmental cooperation, and it's demonstrated this commitment with deeds rather than rhetoric. I don't think that there are many people involved in government at the state or local level who would not at this point admit that this administration has delivered on its commitment to do something for the first time about intergovernmental communication and cooperation. We intend to continue to develop a new spirit of cooperation among all the levels of government, and to that end, we warmly welcome your support. I do appreciate this opportunity that you've given me to kick off not just the campaign this morning in these remarks to you, but at the same time to reach out and summarize some of the very difficult and pressing problems, some of the problems that require great professionalism and great bipartisanship to solve. Because when this campaign is over, regardless of who the winners are going to be, these problems are going to continue. And because a campaign is here, we cannot sweep them under a rug. We cannot generalize solutions. We must attack the specifics that gnaw at the vitals of our cities and our local governments today. And we're going to do that as, with the greatest dedication, I can assure you, campaign on or campaign off. Thank you very much.
Vice President Spiro Agnew, speaking to the 58th Annual Conference of the International City Management Association in Minneapolis.